42. The Tommyknocker stood at the edge of the clearing, looking at Dick. More arrived each minute. They arrived, then just stopped, like simple computer devices whose few programmed operations had all been performed. They stood looking from the canted plane of the ship, to Dick, back to the ship, to Dick again. They were like a crowd of sleepwalkers at a tennis match. Dick could sense the others who had gone back to the village to run the border defenses also simply waiting, looking through the eyes of those who were actually here. Behind them, growing closer, gaining strength, came the fire. Already the clearing had begun to fill with tendrils of smoke. A few people coughed, but no one moved. Dick looked back at them, puzzled. What exactly did they want from him? Then he understood. He was the last of the shed people. The rest of them were gone, and directly or indirectly, the death of each had been Gardner's fault. It was really inexplicable, and more than a little frightening. Dick became more and more convinced that nothing quite like this had happened in all of the Tommyknocker's long, long experience.
They're looking at me because I'm the last. I'm supposed to tell them what to do next.
But there was nothing they could do. There had been a race, and Gardner should have lost, but somehow he hadn't, and now there was nothing to do but wait. Watch, and wait, and hope that the ship would kill him somehow before he could do anything, before... A large hand suddenly reached into Dick Allison's head and squeezed the meat of his brain. His hands flew up to his temples. The fingers flayed into stiff, galvanic spider shapes. He tried to scream, but was unable. Below him, in the clearing, he was vaguely aware that people were falling to their knees in ranks, like pilgrims witnessing a miracle or a divine visitation. The ship had begun to vibrate. The sound filled the air with a thick, suboral hum. Dick was aware of this, and then, as his eyes blew out of his head like half-congealed chunks of moldy jelly, he knew no more, then or ever. 43.
Little help, God, we got a deal.
He sat in the middle of the canted, hexagonal room, his twisted, broken leg stuck out in front of him, croggled. That word wouldn't go away, his leg had been croggled, near where the thick master cable came out of the gasket in the floor.
Little help for the kid. I know I'm not much. Shot my wife, good fucking deal. Shot my best friend, another good fucking deal. A new and approved good fucking deal, you might say, but please, God, I need an assist right now.
That was no exaggeration, either. He needed more than just a little. The thick cable split off into 8 thinner ones, each ending not in an earplug, but in a set of headphones. If he had been playing Russian roulette back in Bobby's shed, this was like sticking his head into a cannon and asking someone to pull the lanyard. But it had to be done. He picked up one set of phones, noticing again how the centers bulged inward, and then looked toward the tangle of brown, sear bodies in the far corner of the room. Tommyknockers? Hey, nonny, nonny, nonsense, name or not, it was still too good for them. Cavemen from space, that was all they had been. Long claws, operating machinery they made but didn't even try to understand. Toes like the spurs on fighting cocks. This thing was a malignant tumor that needed quick removal.
Please, God, let my little idea be right.
Could he tap all of them? That was really the $64,000 question, wasn't it? If the becoming was a closed system, something on the skin of the ship simply biodegrading into the atmosphere, the answer was probably no. But Gardner had come to think, or perhaps only to hope, that it was more. That it was an open system where the ship fed the humans, causing them to become, and the humans fed the ship so it could... What? Come again, of course. Could one use the word resurrection? Sorry, no. Too noble. If he was right, this was a kind of freak show parthenogenesis, whose proper place was under tawdry carnival light and in cheap tabloids, not in undying myths or religious creeds. An open system, a slave system, quite literally, a go-fuck-yourself system.
Please, God, a little help right now.
Gardner donned the headphones. It happened instantaneously, no sensation of pain this time, only a great white radiance. The lights in the control room flashed up to full bright. One of the walls turned into a window again, showing the smoky sky and the fringe of trees. And then another of the room's eight walls went transparent. Another, another. In a space of seconds, Guard seemed to be sitting in an open space with the sky above him and the trench with its silvery netting on either side. The ship seemed to have disappeared. He had a 360-degree view. Motors kicked in one by one and cycled up to full running pitch. A bell was ringing somewhere. Huge, thudding relays kicked over one by one, making the metal deck shiver under him. The feeling of power was incredible. He felt as though the Mississippi was running through his head at flood level. He sensed it was killing him, but that was okay.
I've tapped them all,
Gardner thought faintly.
Oh, God, thank you, God, I've tapped them all. It worked.
The ship began to tremble, to vibrate. The vibration became spasms of racking shudders. The time had come. Baring the last few of his teeth, Gardner prepared to reach down and grasp his own bootstraps. 44. He had tapped all of them, but it was Dick Allison because of his greater evolution, and Hazel's 40 or so border watchers back in town who bore the brunt of the ship's powering up process. These latter were all tied together neatly in one unified web, and the ship simply reached out for it. They slumped over, blood trickling from their eyes and noses, and died as the ship sucked their brains up. The ship drew from the Tommyknockers in the woods as well, and several of the older ones died. Most, however, felt only an excruciating pain in their heads as they either knelt or lay half-fainting around the perimeter of the clearing. A few understood that the fire was very close now. As the wind freshened, that burning lady's fan spread and spread. Smoke ran across the clearing in thick grayish-white clouds. The fire crackled and thundered. 45.
Now,
Gardner thought. He felt something in his mind slip. Catch, slip. And catch firmly. It was like a gear shift. There was pain, but it was bearable.
They're feeling most of the pain,
he thought faintly. The sides of the trench appeared to move. At first, just a little. Then a little more. There was a grinding, squealing sound. Gardner bore down, his brow locked in a tremendous frown, his eyes squeezed into slits. The silvery mesh began to slip past, slowly but steadily. Not that it was moving at all, of course. It was the ship that was moving. That grinding noise was the sound of it pulling itself free of the bedrock which had held it so long.
Going up,
he thought incoherently.
Ladies' lingerie, hosiery notions, and be sure to visit our pet department.
It was gaining speed, the trench walls passing more quickly to either side. The sky widened out ahead. It was a dull gunmetal color. Sparks twisted by like formations of tiny burning birds. He brimmed with exultation. Gardner thought of looking out of a subway window as the train left the station, slowly at first, then beginning to speed up. How the tile walls seemed to unroll backward like the strip of paper in a player piano. How you could read the ads as they passed from left to right. Annie, a chorus line, these times demand the times, touch the velvet. Then into the darkness where there was only movement and a vague sensation of black walls rushing past. A klaxon went off three times, nearly deafening him, making him shriek. Fresh blood spattered into his lap. The ship shuddered and rumbled and squealed and dragged itself out of the earth's crypt. It rose into thickening bands of smoke and hazy sunlight, its polished flank coming out of the trench, out and out and up, a moving metal wall. One standing right next to this insane sight might have been tempted to believe that the earth was creating a stainless steel mountain or injecting a titanium wall into the air. As the arc of the edge grew broader and broader, it reached the edges of the trench Bobby and Gardner had dug steadily wider, ripping at the earth with their smart, stupid tools like halfwits trying to perform a cesarean section. Up and out and out and up, rocks squealed, the earth moaned, dust and the smoke of friction fumed from the trench. Up close, the illusion of an emerging mountain or wall held, but even from such a short distance away as the edge of the clearing, the thing's circular shape was revealed. The titanic shape of the saucer now emerging from the earth like a great engine. It was silent, but the clearing was filled with a coarse thunder of breaking rock. Up and out it came, cutting the trench wider and wider, its shadow gradually covering the whole clearing and burning woods. Its leading edge, the one Bobby had stumbled over, sheared off the top of the tallest spruce in the forest and set it tumbling and crashing to the ground. And still the ship birthed itself from the womb which had held it so long, continued until it covered the whole sky and was reborn. Then it stopped cutting the trench wider. A moment later there was actually a gap between the edges of the trench and the edge of the emerging ship. Its center had at last been reached and passed. The ship rumbled out of the smoky trench, emerging into the smoky sunshine, and at last the squealing, rumbling sound ceased, and there was daylight between the ground and the ship. It was out. It rose on a slanted, canted angle, and then came to the horizontal, crushing trees with its unknown, unknowable weight, bursting their trunks open. Sap sprayed the air with thin amber veils. It moved with slow, ponderous elegance through the burning day, cutting a swath along the tops of the trees like a clipper trimming a hedge. Then it hovered, as if waiting for something. 46. Now the floor below Gardner was also transparent. He seemed to be sitting in thin air, looking down at the billowing reefs of smoke coming from the edge of the woods and filling the air. The ship was fully alive now, but he was fading fast. His hands crept up to the earphones.
Scotty,
he thought.
Give me warp speed. We're blowing this disco.
He bore down hard inside his mind, and this time the pain was thick and fibrous and sickening.
Meltdown,
he thought dimly.
This is what meltdown feels like.
There was a sensation of tremendous speed. A hand knocked him sprawling to the deck, although there was no sensation of multi-G force. The Tommyknockers had apparently found a way to beat that. The ship didn't tilt. It simply rose straight up into the air. Instead of blotting out the whole sky, it blotted out only three quarters, then half. It grew indistinct in the smoke, its hard-edged metal alloy reality growing fuzzy and thus dreamy. Then it was gone in the smoke, leaving only the dazed, drained Tommyknockers to try to find their feet before the fire could overtake them. It left the Tommyknockers and the clearing, the lean-to, and the trench, like a black socket from which some poisonous fang had been drawn. 47. Guard lay on the floor of the control room, staring up. As he watched, the smoky, chromed look of the sky disappeared. It became blue again, the brightest, clearest blue he had ever seen. Gorgeous, he tried to say, but no word came out, not even a croak. He swallowed blood and coughed, his eyes never leaving that brilliant sky. Its blue deepened to indigo, then to purple.
Please don't let it stop now, please.
Purple to black. And now, in that blackness, he saw the first hard chips of stars. The klaxon blared again. He felt fresh pain as the ship drew from him, and there was a sensation of increasing speed as it slipped into a higher gear.
Where are we going?
Gardner thought incoherently. And then the blackness overtook him as the ship fled up and out, escaping the envelope of the Earth's atmosphere as easily as it had escaped the ground which had held it for so long.
Where are we?
Up and up. Out and out the ship rose, and Jim Gardner, born in Portland, Maine, went with it. He drifted down through black levels of unconsciousness, and shortly before the final vomiting began, a vomiting of which he was never even aware, he had a dream. A dream so real that he smiled as he lay in the middle of blackness, surrounded by space, and with the earth below him like a giant blue-gray croaker marble.
He had gotten through it. Somehow gotten through it. Patricia McCardle had tried to break him, but she had never quite been able to do it. Now he was back in Haven. And there was Bobby coming down the porch steps and across the dooryard to meet him. And Peter was barking and wagging his tail, and Guard grabbed Bobby and hugged her, because it was good to be with your friends, good to be where you belonged, good to have some safe haven to come to.
Lying on the transparent floor of the control room, already better than 70,000 miles out in space, Jim Gardner lay in a widening pool of his own blood and smiled. Epilogue. Curl up, baby. Curl up tight. Curl up, baby. Keep it all out of sight. Undercover. Keep it all out of sight. Undercover of the night. The Rolling Stones. Undercover. Oh, every night and every day, a little piece of you is falling away. Toe your line and play their game. Let the anesthetic cover it all till one day they call your name. You're only waiting for the hammer to fall. Queen. Hammer to fall. One. Most of them died in the fire. Not all. 100 or more never reached the clearing at all before the ship pulled itself out of the ground and disappeared into the sky. Some, like Elt Barker, who had gone flying off his motorcycle, did not reach it because they had been wounded or killed on the way. Fortunes of war. Others, like Ashley Raval and old Miss Timms, who was the town librarian on Tuesdays and Thursdays, were simply too late or too slow. Nor were all of those who did reach the clearing killed. The ship had gone into the sky, and the awful draining power which had seized them dwindled away to nothing before the fire reached the clearing, although by then the sparks were drifting down, and many of the smaller trees at the eastern edge were blazing. Some of them managed to stumble and limp further into the woods ahead of that spreading, fiery fan. Of course, going straight west was no good to these few. Rosalie Skeen was among them, as were Frank Spruce and Rudy Barfield, brother of the late and mostly unlamented Pitt, because eventually they would run out of breathable air in spite of the prevailing wind. So it was necessary to first go west and then turn either south or north in an effort to buttonhook around the fire front, a desperation play where the penalty for failure was not losing the ball, but being roasted to cinders in big engine wood. A few, not all, but a few, actually did make it. Most, however, died in the clearing where Bobby Anderson and Jim Gardner had worked so long and hard, died within feet of that empty socket where something had been buried and then pulled. They had been used roughly by a power which was much greater than the early, tentative state of their becoming could cope with. The ship had reached out to the net of their mind, seized it, and used it to obey the controller's weak but unmistakable command, which had been expressed as warp speed to the ship's organic cybernetic circuit. The words warp speed were not in the ship's vocabulary, but the concept was clear. The living lay on the ground, most unconscious, some deeply dazed. A few sat up, holding their heads and moaning, oblivious of the sparks drifting down around them. Some, mindful of the danger coming from the east, tried to get up and fell back. One of those who did not fall back was Chip McCausland, who lived on Dugout Road with his common-law wife and about 10 kids. 2 months and 1,000,000 years ago, Bobby Anderson had gone to Chip for more egg cartons to hold her expanding collection of batteries. Chip shambled halfway across the clearing like an old drunk and fell into the empty trench. He tumbled, shrieking, all the way to the bottom, where he died of a broken neck and a shattered skull. Others, who understood the danger of the fire and who could possibly have gotten away, elected not to do so. The becoming was at an end. It had ended with the departure of the ship. The purpose of their lives had been canceled. So they only sat and waited for the fire to take care of what remained of them. 2. By nightfall, there were less than 200 people left alive in Haven. Most of the township's heavily wooded western half had burned or was burning flat. The wind grew stronger yet. The air began to change, and the remaining Tommyknockers, gasping and whey-faced, gathered in Hazel McCready's yard. Phil Golden and Bryant Brown got the big air exchanger going. The survivors gathered around it as homesteaders might once have gathered around a stove on a better night. Their tortured breathing gradually eased. Bryant looked over at Phil.
Weather for tomorrow. Clear skies, diminishing wind.
Marie was standing nearby, and Bryant saw her relax.
Good. That's good.
And so it was, for the time being. But the winds were not going to remain calm for the rest of their lives, and with the ship gone, there was only this gadget and 24 truck batteries between them and eventual strangulation.
How long?
Bryant asked, and no one answered. There was only the flat shine of their frightened, inhuman eyes in the fire-shot night. 3. The following morning there were 20 less. During the night, John Leandro's story had broken worldwide with all the force of a hammerfall. State and Defense Departments denied everything, but dozens of people had taken photographs as the ship rose. These photographs were persuasive, and no one could stop the flood of leaks from such informed sources as frightened residents of the surrounding towns and the first arriving National Guardsmen. The Haven border barriers held, at least for the time being. The firefront had advanced into Newport, where the flames were finally being brought under control. Several Tommyknockers blew their brains out in the night. Polly Andrews swallowed Drano. Phil Golden awoke to discover that Queenie, his wife of 20 years, had jumped into Hazel McCready's dry well. That day there were only 4 suicides. But the nights were worse. By the time the Army finally broke into Haven, like inept burglars into a strong safe later that week, there were less than 80 Tommyknockers left. Justin Hurd shot a fat Army sergeant with a kid's Daisy air rifle that squirted green fire. The fat sergeant exploded. A scared E-4 in the APC, just then roaring past Cooter's Market, turned the .50 caliber he was sitting behind on Justin Hurd, who was standing in front of the hardware store, wearing only a yellowing pair of Hanes underpants and his orange work shoes.
"Fix them woodchucks," Justin was screaming. "Fix them all, you're fucking A, you're..."
Then he was hit by some 20 .50 caliber slugs. Justin nearly exploded, too. The E-4 puked into his gas mask and nearly choked on the stuff before someone could get a fresh one over his face.
"Someone get that pop gun,"
a major shouted through an electric bullhorn. His mask muffled his words but did not destroy them.
"Get it, but be careful. Pick it up by the barrel. I repeat, be extremely careful. Don't point it at anyone."
"Pointing it at someone," Guard would have said, "always comes later." 4. More than a dozen were shot down on the first day of the invasion by scared, trigger-happy soldiers, kids, most of them, who pursued the Tommyknockers from house to house. After a while, some of the invaders' fear began to rub off. By afternoon, they were actually having fun. They were like men driving rabbits through wheat. 2 dozen more were killed before the Army doctors and Pentagon brain trusters realized that the air outside of Haven was lethal to these freak show mutations who had once been American taxpayers. The fact that the invaders could not breathe the air inside Haven would have seemed to have made the converse self-evident, but in all the excitement, no one was really thinking very well. Guard wouldn't have found this very surprising. Now there were only 40 or so. Most were insane. Those who weren't wouldn't talk. A makeshift stockade was built in the area which passed for a town square in Haven Village, just below and to the right of the towerless town hall. They were kept there for another week, and during that period another 14 died. The changed air was analyzed, the machine which manufactured it was carefully studied, the failing batteries were replaced. As Bobby had suggested, it didn't take the brain trusters long to understand the mechanics of the device, and the underlying principles were already being studied at MIT, Caltech, Bell Labs, and the shop in Virginia by scientists who were nearly vomiting with excitement. The remaining 26 Tommyknockers, looking like the weary, pox-rattled remnants of the final Apache tribe in existence, were flown in the controlled environment cargo bay of a C-140 Starlifter to a government installation in Virginia. This installation, which had once been burned to the ground by a child, was the shop. There they were studied, and there they died. One by one by one. The last survivor was Alice Kimball, the schoolteacher who was a lesbian, a fact Becca Paulson had learned from Jesus one hot day in July. She died on October 31st, Halloween. 5. At about the same time Queenie Golden was standing on the edge of Hazel's dry well and preparing to jump in, a nurse stepped into Hilly Brown's room to check on the boy, who had shown some faint signs of returning consciousness over the last couple of days. She looked at the bed and frowned. She couldn't be seeing what she was seeing. It was an illusion of some kind, a double shadow thrown onto the wall by the light from the corridor. She flipped the wall switch and took a step closer. Her mouth dropped open. It hadn't been an illusion. There were 2 shadows on the wall because there were 2 boys in the bed. They slept with their arms wrapped around each other.
What?
She took another step, her hand going unconsciously to the crucifix she wore around her neck. One of them, of course, was Hilly Brown, his face thin and wasted, his arms seemingly no thicker than sticks, his skin nearly as white as his hospital Johnny. She didn't know the other boy, who was very young. He was wearing blue shorts and a T-shirt which read, "They call me Dr. Love." His feet were black with dirt, and something about that dirt seemed unnatural to her.
"What?"
she whispered again. And the younger boy stirred and wrapped his arms more tightly around Hilly's neck. His cheek rested against Hilly's shoulder, and she saw with something like terror that the boys looked very much alike. She decided she had to tell Dr. Greenleaf about this. Right now. She turned to leave, heart beating fast, one hand still clutching at her crucifix, and saw something that was quite impossible.
"What?"
she whispered for the third and last time. Her eyes were very wide. More of that strange black dirt. On the floor. Tracks on the floor leading to the bed. The little boy had crossed to the bed and gotten in. The two boys' facial resemblance suggested that this was Hilly's missing and long since presumed dead brother. The tracks didn't come from the hall. They started in the middle of the floor, as if the little boy had come from nowhere. The nurse bolted from the room, screaming for Dr. Greenleaf. 6. Hilly Brown opened his eyes.
"David?"
"Shut up, Hilly, I'm sleeping."
Hilly smiled, not sure where he was, not sure when he was, sure only that many things had been wrong. Just what those things had been no longer mattered, because everything was okay now. David was here, warm and solid against him.
"Me too," Hilly said. "We got to trade G.I. Joe's tomorrow."
"Why?"
"I don't know. But we got to, I promise."
"When?"
"I don't know.
As long as I get crystal ball,"
David said, settling himself more firmly into the crook of Hilly's arm.
"Well, okay."
Silence. There was a dim commotion at the nurse's station down the hall. But here there was silence and the sweet warmth of boys.
"Hilly?"
"What?"
Hilly muttered.
"It was cold where I was."
"Was it?"
"Yes." Yeah.
"Better now?"
"Better. I love you, Hilly."
"I love you too, David. I'm sorry."
"For what?"
"I don't know."
"Oh."
David's hand groped for the blanket, found it, and pulled it up. 93 million miles from the sun and 100 parsecs from the axis pole of the galaxy, Hilly and David Brown slept in each other's arms. August 19, 1982. May 19, 1987. Grateful acknowledgement is made for permission to reprint excerpts from the following copyrighted material. Thank the Lord for the Nighttime by Neil Diamond. Copyright 1967, Talleyrand Music Incorporated. All rights reserved. Used by permission. Run Through the Jungle by John Fogerty. Copyright 1970, John Dora Music. Courtesy Fantasy Incorporated. Downstream. Bob Walkenhorst. Copyright 1986 by Screen Gems EMI Music Incorporated and Bob Walkenhorst Music. All administrative rights controlled by Screen Gems EMI Music Incorporated. Drinking on the Job. Bob Walkenhorst. Copyright 1986 by Screen Gems EMI Music Incorporated and Bob Walkenhorst Music. All administrative rights controlled by Screen Gems EMI Music Incorporated. Undercover of the Night. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards. Copyright 1983 by EMI Music Publishing Limited. All administrative rights for the United States and Canada controlled by Colgem, EMI Music Incorporated. Hammer to Fall. Brian May. Copyright 1984 by Queen Music Limited. All administrative rights for the United States and Canada controlled by Beechwood Music Corporation. End of the Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Narrated by Pam Ward in the studios of Talking Books Publishing Company for the Library of Congress, October 1988. For special distribution is authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522 with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, G.P. Putnam Sons, 200 Madison Avenue, New York, New York, 10016. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container flaps or latches before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container braille side down for identification.